So our guest is Elaine Kozlova, who is the author of this brand new book. Boy, are we like hot here getting a real writer.
Hot off the griddle.
Hot off the griddle with a really good press, not one of these local vanity. I'm sorry, I shouldn't make fun of those people. They are serious. Algonquin Press, one of my favorite presses, because when I was in the book critical business, I used to love the fiction published by Algonquin. They were a Southern press, started in North Carolina by Shannon Ravenel, and who was a famous editor in her time. And it's a great press. Anyway, Elaine, hello, welcome.
Thank you. Yes, hello, Ellen and
I finished
Tom.
The book at about noon today.
Mm-hmm.
So you can expect a lot of questions.
Great. All right.
But I'll let Ellen go first because she's hot to talk about butter because she eats a lot of it.
I don't. I eat a lot of butter.
Yeah, don't you?
I love bread and I love butter. Mm. So
yeah, my favorite combination.
Exactly. Let me hold off a second. I want to make a special alert. You know how you're supposed to tell children you're talking about adult material? I want to let all vegans know they might want to turn off their radios because we're going to be talking about butter, and I know how butter upsets you, but I never understand why. Because like Indians who respect cows still eat butter. They don't eat meat, but they do eat dairy products, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, yes.
Okay,
yes.
So that alert is over.
Yes, Indians on the Indian continent. Yes, indeed.
But cows give it freely and, you know.
Well, that's not what vegans say, you know.
Okay. I just wanted to comment first on the reviews, stunning reviews this
Thank
book
you.
Got.
Thank you.
And how the subject matter is handled by the reviewers. Because one said, oh, dear.
That's well, what they said? Somebody wrote, oh, dear? That's a weird review.
No, I got my notes mixed up.
Okay,
I'll tell you what I like.
The fact that, you know, books come with blurbs, but this one has a blurb from the only food writer, well, one of two food writers who means mm-hmm. anything to me, and that is Mimi Sheridan. Mm. You know Mimi?
Thank you. Yes.
Do you know her?
Yes. Well, cool. I do now. I mean, I was introduced to her by a friend recently. And
oh, cool.
So when I wrote the book, I didn't actually know her.
Oh, so that goes a long way because she's really one of the greatest.
Yeah.
Okay, I found what I was talking about, how the imaginative use of butter references in reviewing this book. One says, it's a fascinating, tasty read. Another says, a tasty chronicle of the indispensable dairy product. Her richly textured history melts in your mouth.
Mm, yes.
Well, it begins, Ellen,
of
course, with the very subtitle, A Rich History, which is, of course, a play on the words.
Yes.
But let's let Elaine talk a little bit.
Mm.
How did you get started in this project?
So I really became interested in the history of butter through the science and craft of butter making. What many readers, listeners actually, and readers as well, don't know is that I spent almost 5 years as the editor of a cheese magazine. So I was behind the scenes in the dairy world, you know, really getting to know the animals and you know, and the pasture and the farmers and the processing. And, you know, obviously to understand cheese, but in the process, I sampled a lot of butters domestically and around the world, and I became kind of fascinated how butter is this like really fresh expression of a place, you know, even more so than, say, wine, because it's, you know, it's just made so quickly. And so you get these nuances based on what the butter maker's doing, what the animals are eating, what the animals are, what breed they are. You know, there's these wonderful variables that all play together to create these nuances in butter. And,
so
and you see that when you have a sample of butters laid out in front of you.
And your book is just about animal-derived butters, not the other type of butters we know of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, the word terroir, you know you love when I say French, Ellen, so I said that, comes up in the book. And, you know, we know it more from wine discussion, but it's the same thing, right? I mean, that's what you're talking about. There's so many variables that go into, and your book goes from what's in the ground through the cow and comes out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, feeding a cow grain versus feeding a cow grass has a tremendous influence on the butter. But then whether a butter maker, you know, chooses to culture the cream, how they work the butter afterwards, you know, there's lots of subtleties that I really became fascinated with and, you know, and still to this point. But there's, you know, I wanted also people to obviously understand the history of butter, because that's something I kind of stumbled upon as I was studying the craft. I was like amazed at the history of butter. And at that point I thought, oh, there's a book here for sure, you know, because I didn't think I could win an audience just writing about the science and craft, certainly not a general audience. Right. So,
and you talk about field research, but it's really kind of almost participatory journalism.
Yeah, yeah.
And you begin with an anecdote of watching a butter maker in Bhutan. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes, yes, yes. I was really keen on documenting butter making around the world as much as I could afford, honestly. And I wanted also to see butter making as it's done from different animals. And in Bhutan, it's specifically yak butter. And yak butter, I had heard, you know, has a reputation of being awful and rancid. And I'd heard all these things from people that go hiking, you know, in the Himalayas. So I was determined to go and see for myself. And I went off to Bhutan with my husband. And we hiked not easily up to about 13,000 feet to live among some of the, I shouldn't say live, but camp among some of the yak herders there.
Who are nomadic.
Who are nomadic. And they make yak butter every day. They milk their yak every day, you know, in season, certainly not in the winter. So I got to see that and, you know, participate in the butter making, which is very primitive. It has not changed for a thousand or more years. I mean, it's the same primitive
equipment.
That's
so cool. They use the old-fashioned churning.
Yeah, the old-fashioned plunger, wooden plunger churn. There's no sink. There's no kitchen. There's no strainer. You know, it's just this. Actually, I have a video of it, you know, that I love to show. It's like almost like this dance she does with her hands. It's really beautiful to see. And the yak butter, surprisingly enough, is really mild when you have it fresh. It's actually not even as sweet as cow's milk butter. But I think by the time it gets down to the markets and the valleys, you know, there's no refrigeration. And we're talking about summertime, springtime, fall. And it's raw. It does. There's a lot of cultures in there, you know, so it ferments very quickly. There's probably a stage at where it's quite nice, but it can quickly go toward rancid. But I believe in the Himalayas, they have a taste for that. The same way we like a really strong blue cheese, they love rancid butter. They don't seem to mind it, but they use it mostly in their tea. You don't see a lot of toast in Bhutan. I didn't see any toast in Bhutan.
It's interesting the way you talk about butter through history and how finer butters eventually sort of separate from, you know, butter that's been rancid, and how the rancid butter gets reused and sold to people who can't afford the good butter, and how that changes over time. And and really, so many things parallel the general history of food anyway. I mean, especially when refrigeration comes in. Yeah. And that changes
Big
the whole game.
Changer.
And
right.
then the other thing is, now with the slow food movement going from trying to make this universal homogenized product to actually going the reverse and having all kinds of local butters. And you spend time on that too, right? I mean, you're interested.
Yes, yes. I mean, I visited industrial producers as well. That's a big part of the story. And
big butter, I was thinking.
Big butter.
Big butter is watching
you.
Yeah,
yeah. And, you know, I have to say, it's easy to have issues with industrial dairying that feeds industrial butter production. You know, that's a whole separate issue when you talk about animals and treatment. But as far as industrial production itself, I mean, it's a really clean, pure system. There's not a lot of additives. It's basically a mechanical system. You know, the cream goes in, 3 seconds later, butter comes out because they have these very fast-moving augers. You know, I have no grudge against the industrialists. I think we can be very happy that the butter we get in the supermarket is affordable, it's consistent, you know, your cookies always come out the same. But at the same time, a lot of my book is kind of lauding this trend toward artisanal handmade production. It's more interesting. You get it.
That's what comes through vividly, is that it's not about just one type of butter. Not only is it not about one type of animal butter, but it's also about, you know, something that you eat right the moment it's churned versus something that ages. I mean, there's all kinds of, there's so many different types of butter is what comes through pretty vividly in the book.
Yeah.
And I also, of course, love the fact that you focus, you tell your story partly through characters.
Mm-hmm.
And getting back to the churns, for example, you could tell us about Sandeep Agnawal.
Agarwal. Yes.
This is interesting, Ellen.
Yeah, a man in New Jersey who, how did I find out about him? I'm trying to remember. I think a friend of mine had heard about, he did an exhibit called Butter World, which is essentially he took all of his butter making collection, his, you know, he has equipment and paraphernalia that he's collected for years and years. It's a hobby of his. And he exhibited it at this fair, I believe it was County Fair, and he calls it Butter World. And then he packs it up and puts it back in his storage unit in New Jersey, and it sits there most of the time. So I contacted him, told him about the book and how I really would love to see some of his equipment. And he, you know, on a cold December day, he met me in the outskirts of New, you know, Trenton, I believe, and opened up his storage unit. It was like a treasure trove. It was so magnificent. So many beautiful things he has, and really some very, very old, centuries old, some things that he's collected.
And part of his interest was his remembering his own mother making mm-hmm. butter and
yes,
the Indian version,
India.
Which is right. called, is it ghee or how do you say that?
Ghee.
Ghee.
Ghee. Yeah, yeah.
Which is.
Yes, his family has always made.
Well, sort of,
you know.
If you read the book, Ellen.
Yeah, all ghee is clarified butter, but not all clarified butter is ghee.
Yeah.
So that's how I explain that. But yeah, and he's a ghee maker himself. I mean, he produces ghee commercially. He sells a really good organic ghee. So yeah, that was wonderful. I'm hoping we can do something together where we bring out his stuff again, mm-hmm. where I can talk and he can show a little dog and pony show.
Well, there's all these great things, you know. I mean, there's so many anecdotal and historical aspects. For example, you could tell us about bog butter. This is interesting, Ellen, because I'm a great fan. I don't know if you know the book by Glob. It's called The Bog People.
No.
It's a famous study of the bog people that they discovered.
Oh.
And it's a classic.
Glob?
No, that's the author's name. That's what's so incredible.
Yeah.
I think it's P.G. Glob wrote The Bog People.
Oh.
And it's been reprinted over time.
Oh.
But it's about the discovery of these people fairly well preserved in the bog.
Yes.
But you have a related story.
Right. Because butter, as it turns out, is well preserved when put in a bog for 1,000 years. You can preserve butter to some extent.
Wow.
Yeah,
and they have it, Ellen. There's actually places that have this butter.
Yes. Can you taste it?
If you're a historian, you might be able to get to try it. I went to the Cork Butter Museum in Ireland, where they have on display a 1,000-year-old piece of
butter museum.
A whole butter museum.
And there's a reason why, right?
Yeah, this piece of
Cork. I mean,
yeah,
it's
the city of Cork.
Yeah.
Yeah, the city of Cork is famous for its butter making. It was, at one time, it was the center of butter making in the world. The Irish, you know, had a thriving business shipping butter around the world to the West Indies, to different continents. But they eventually lost out to the Danish, who were much more innovative around the late 19th century. But the bog butter, to tell you about the bog butter, it's easy to jump around because the history is so varied and fascinating.
Yeah.
The ancient Irish, and, you know, people were burying bog butter at least 1,000 years ago in this, mm-hmm. what we now call Ireland. And what I found in my research was cool because, of course, everybody was like, oh, yeah, they buried it in the bog to preserve it. They didn't have refrigeration. But we have found over 400 samples of bog butter. So why the heck were they leaving it there?
Mm.
You know, like, it was really valuable to these people. And so now they've mapped out where they found the bog butters. And it seems pretty clear that these were pagan offerings. Because, you know, to the fairies, to the elementals, because they have found them in particular sites that were ancient boundaries, it's like sacred boundaries in the world way back then, the Irish world back then. So it's interesting to think, you know, that butter was this, you know, sacrificial offering.
And you talk about butter in other religious cultures, too.
Yeah, there's a whole chapter that I found fascinating to research. I had no idea that butter was, you know, this sacred tool for so many ancient peoples, the Sumerians, the Vedic Aryans, the Hindus, the Buddhists, the Druids. They all had different rituals that involved using butter.
Mm.
Yeah, it was really, really fun chapter to research. And that continues today with the Tibetan Buddhists, because they still have elaborate butter carvings that they create for their prayer festivals. It's like central to being a Tibetan Buddhist. You have to have what's called a torma, is a sculpture that's made out of butter. Although in India, they now use like wax and margarine. many of them are exiled in India, so they can't use butter. But traditionally, it was always done with butter, probably yak butter, in Tibet. And they're exquisite. There's a film called Torma Film, yeah. I think. And if you want to see the whole process.
The woman who made it lives up around here somewhere,
yeah,
right?
She's a nun who lives across the river at a retreat, or she did the last time I spoke to her. Anyway.
Well, speaking of butter sculptures, you also visit the woman who does, was it the Iowa Fair butter sculpture?
Yeah, the Iowa State Fair, yeah. I spent a week.
And it has a very sort of unsavory aspect to it, Ellen.
Yeah. Yeah, my first reaction going into her workspace, which is essentially a refrigerated room with a glass. It's where it's going to be displayed. You know, she does it where it will be displayed, so it's like this glass refrigerated case. And I walked in and just gagged immediately because it's 600 pounds of rancid butter.
They reuse the butter, Ellen.
But that's very,
so disgusting.
But it's so moral. Yeah. I'm like, of course they do. True. You know, it's really good. They don't waste the butter.
True.
So, and I got used to it eventually. Yeah. But that I spent about a week out there in my down coat inside this refrigerated unit in the middle of the summer, just to see how it's done. Because it's done all over now, but I wanted to go to one of the fairs where it was sort of started, you know, started out there.
So what did she make statues of?
Cow.
She made a cow. The butter cow was the first thing. Yeah, now everybody does, you know, celebrities and so forth. But
someday, Ellen.
Marilyn Monroe.
Someday you'll be memorialized in butter. To switch gears a little bit, let's talk about the anti-butter aspects, which begins not necessarily with research about fat, but with the Greeks and Romans, who were apparently...
Yes. You picked up on that.
Well, I was trying to understand my own aversion to butter.
Tell me.
Your aversion to butter?
It's only because I grew up with olive oil.
That's true.
My father is Italian-American,
it doesn't have to be one or the other.
It doesn't. No, I know that. Yeah. I know that. But I also, that's why I was struck by, especially as I get older, at one point you mentioned that the lactose enzyme, digesting enzyme, recedes with age.
Yeah.
And I found that to be true in my own case. So.
Right. But you really don't have to worry about that with butter so much.
Oh, you don't?
Really
okay.
Really a milk and cheese
issue. Oh, that's good to know.
Mm. Yes. Yeah.
No, I eat butter. I just don't use it the way a lot of people do in terms constantly. I use olive oil.
Olive oil is great, too. I hope you're getting real olive oil, by the
way. Oh, yeah.
You read that article about...
Not that part.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I drive my wife crazy with how much I spend on olive oil.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know,
but that's the case with anything like this, right?
Yeah, I spend a lot on butter.
Exactly. Because I'm definitely going to go try some of these.
Yeah. Okay.
By the way, Ellen, there's a good list in the back of...
Oh, I was going to say,
all the best butters.
Butter?
Oh, there's...
So many.
There's so many.
So many good butters. Yeah, I really hate to choose a favorite.
Puglia is available, right?
Do you mean plougras?
Plougras.
That's available in the local supermarket.
Yep.
But
and if you haven't looked in a while, you might see many more because it's definitely expanding the whole butter selection.
I've seen Irish butter there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Kerrygold, that gets around really well. Yeah. Well, all good stuff.
By the way, Ellen, anywhere in the world you want to go, bring this book because you'll find how they say butter.
You could take a butter tour.
Albanian word for a butter is in here. I can't pronounce it, but it's there.
Yeah. Yeah, I did that index in the back. I was enchanted with that for some reason.
Yeah, that's
like
cool.
All these different names
all
for
the
butter.
All the little extras are really
There's
cool.
something almost poetic about it. I just had to include it. So,
Marcella Hazan, who's a great Italian cook, wrote a cookbook. And in it, she has a tomato sauce called tomato sauce with butter and onion.
Mm.
And the recipe requires, I think it's 2 cups of crushed tomatoes. They can be canned or fresh, doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
A half an onion.
Okay.
Peeled, cut in half, and just put in with the tomatoes. A little salt, maybe. And 5 tablespoons of butter.
Mm-hmm.
And it is delicious.
Well, you know, it speaks to a quotation in the book from Anthony Bourdain, which is that, you know, the secret in most restaurants is they always keep a little butter on the side and throw it in there either.
Yeah, it can kind of like smooth out the edges and it carries more of the flavor.
Yeah.
You need fat to carry flavor, right?
Well, so. I mentioned this sauce to Billy Letta, who has the Italian deli on the corner over here.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, that's French. That's not Italian.
That's the cliche that the French use butter,
French
the Italian
use butter,
stuff.
The Italians
but
use
it's not
olive.
Necessarily true.
Yeah.
I guess not.
I mean, they're all kind of historical and cultural. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you read the book, you realize that there's so many, what shall we say, extra buttery reasons for things evolving the way they did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But let's get to the more serious
aspect
of the attack on butter, and that is the health scare that began with a certain academic, I can't remember his name, but who wrote
But let me just mention, I never actually answered your question about the Greeks and Romans.
Oh, yeah.
Right,
sorry.
So,
good. No, please
and then we can, you know, talk about current adversaries of butter. Mm-hmm. The Greeks and Romans associated butter with the barbarians of the north. And
I still do. No,
and so it was not a food that they liked or prized or had any interest in whatsoever. But they did use it as a medicinal commodity. You know, it's used as an ointment.
If you burn your hand.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true.
I should have looked that up
in the book. Yeah, I should have looked that up.
It's what my grandmother used to do, but I wasn't convinced.
So it was in their medicine chest, but not on their table.
Hmm.
My book goes into, of course, the long battle with, you know, the sort of diet dictocrats of the last century who said, you know, butter gives you heart attack. You know, butter is bad for you. And it's
part of the attack on all animal fat.
On all animal fat, primarily. But, you know, you didn't see much. I mean, I didn't see in so much of the media as much attack on, say, you know, pork or, you know, certain kinds of meat were fine. It feels like butter and cream particularly, you know, took the heat for a lot of the saturated fat.
Why was
concern.
That? Concern.
And yeah, I mean, it's a good question, especially considering historically what was going on in the 1900s, as far as our diet and our health, in particular with regard to butter, because in the early part of the century, Americans were eating about 17 pounds of butter per person in the 1920s, per year.
In a year.
And there was very little heart disease in the 1920s. And so, you know, heart disease was low, butter consumption high. By the end of the century, if you look at a graph, butter consumption has dropped to about 4 pounds of butter per person per year. So like this quadruple, you know, change, it plummets essentially. And heart disease has become epidemic. So you have this complete inverse relationship of butter consumption and heart disease. And yet, you know, it took the heat, you know, for a lot of the concerns about heart disease.
And
I think it was also easy to, you know, for the nutritionists and the politicians and people involved in diet policy to say, you know, get rid of the butter, you know, use vegetable oil. Like, that's an easy remedy. If you do that, you know, you're going to be good. Like, you're going to be safer. It's less risk for your heart disease. And I think on a certain level, it intuitively felt right to so many people because they thought, oh, here's this hard, firm fat. When I eat it,
fat creates fat.
But particularly hard, firm fat becomes firm fat on my body, in my arteries, you know, intuitively it felt right. But that is like a completely simplistic notion, and it's not how our digestion and metabolism works at all. You know, it's completely broken down. And
look at you two. You're the butter eaters, and I'm the fat one.
What about...
Do the listeners know that we're slim?
I think that was implied, yeah.
Okay.
Then margarine came along.
Oh, yeah, that's... Yeah.
Well,
during World War II, wasn't
right.
it? Really?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, not the first margarine.
The first margarine came along in the late 1800s. It was created in response to a contest that Napoleon III created because he wanted an alternative to butter to feed his troops. He wanted something that would transport more easily and be cheaper and still palatable. So he created this contest, and a French chemist won with his version of what he called margarine, oleomargarine, he called it. And it was made from beef fat and milk and some food coloring, natural food coloring, and a bit of salt. So it's completely unlike the margarine. Actually, I think it was probably better than what we have now. Yeah, yeah. It certainly was more natural than the margarine that, you know, we inherited. So that was how it got started. It really took off because, as Tom mentioned earlier, you know, earlier today, as we started this interview, there was so much bad butter around in the early 1900s, even late 1800s. There was a lot of rancid butter, dirty butter, moldy butter, you know, without refrigeration, without proper sanitation. You know, you had really very second-rate butter. And that was what the poor could afford. If you were wealthy or merchant class or, you know, middle class, you could generally get decent butter. But if you were poor, you couldn't afford that butter. And so you were left with rancid, lousy butter. And margarine came along as this cheaper alternative that was much more palatable. So it immediately caught on, and people liked that it was less prone to rancidity and spoilage and so forth. So it caught on, and the butter makers, you know, reacted right away and launched essentially a 90-year-long battle to fight the margarine producers. And
with tariffs, you know,
and legislations and regulations. I mean, my book has a chapter detailing what they did to try to drive the margarine producers out of business, including things like requiring butter be dyed pink and black so as to not be confused with butter, and also to clearly stigmatize the product as well as those who bought it. Yeah, it's a fascinating story.
Which people did. I mean, you tell that there's one anecdote, and I saw my father immediately. He always thought when my mother would show up with margarine, he would just like, "Are you kidding? That's disgusting."
My father too. My father too. Yeah.
Well, in World War II, I remember, as will anybody who lived through that era, butter was rationed.
Yes.
That's right. That's talked about in the book.
And so we had margarine in the house, and it came in a white package with a little sort of pill.
Oh, this is in the book.
It was in plastic. It was yellow.
Right?
Yes.
And it was the kids' job always to pinch that and squish around the plastic bag till it looked like butter.
Yes. Yep. I just came back from a three-week-long book tour, and I've heard this story so many times. It's fascinating.
Not all of us lived then,
Ellen.
I know.
I did, but I was, you know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and I had a man also. I had one man argue with me kind of vociferously. You know, I made butter as a kid by squeezing this bag. You know, he was like, "No, it was butter. It was butter." I'm like, "No, I don't think it was butter. You were 3 years old. You don't remember." So, yeah,
he was told it was butter.
And that, you know, little chore was all because of the regulation to, you know, make it
yellow, right?
To make it yellow, but why they didn't just do it at the factory was they wanted to, you know, discourage you from buying margarine. That's basically why it was done. There's no reason they couldn't color it. They could color it. But it was just to discourage the consumers from buying margarine. So, yeah, that's your lawmakers at work.
Mother, but somehow my Aunt Lucy could always had enough coupons to buy butter. There was always butter in her kitchen.
Oh, really? What was she up to on the side?
Because that was more... Yeah,
she was a nurse, a private duty nurse.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that the butter rations were more expensive.
There was a kind of very sly reference to... a veiled reference to Marlon Brando's use of butter.
Yeah.
Do you know what that refers to, Ellen?
No.
Okay, good. We'll leave it at that.
Me? I have no idea.
Good.
Yeah, let's leave it.
And there's a long recipe section, Ellen, which you'll, I'm sure. It's all the classics, you know? How to do all the classics with butter.
Yeah.
And the butter sauces.
Yes, because there's maybe a whole new generation that doesn't know the classics, too. You know,
and also how to make your own.
And
how to make your own.
And sauces. Yeah, even butterscotch. I have a little butterscotch revival in my book.
Oh, good.
Do you remember butterscotch?
Sure.
Ellen? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, we used to have that a lot when I was as a kid. My mother used to make a butterscotch pie. She essentially made a pudding and put it in a pie pan put a little whipped cream on top. And
yeah.
That's not precisely in my book. But yeah, but the butterscotch pudding is in my book. Yeah, I do that.
To get back to the health issue, there's a Dr. Dayspring. Is that his name?
Yeah, Thomas Dayspring.
Who sort of has made his mission to counter the anti-fat and anti-butter movement. Mm-hmm. And his point is that, you know, it's always a holistic picture for individual health. I think, you know, this is more for our listeners to make it clear that, you know, if they're thinking about it, that, you know, it's certainly there are all kinds of reasons for heart disease.
Right.
But it's less clear that butter is a major one of them, or even fat, animal fats are a major one of them. Mm-hmm. I think that's, I mean, I personally, I have problems with digesting fats, but it has nothing to do with, you know, it's a separate issue. And that's what sort of he's saying. It's about your genotype and all these other things that factor in.
Yeah, he makes the point also that for many people to be on a low-fat diet is actually very bad for their constitution. That because you have to get your calories from somewhere. So if you're having a low-fat diet, you're probably having a high carb in response. And that carbohydrate, you know, intake is not good for many of us, particularly because our carbs today tend to be loaded with sugar, even though we don't even know it. Our breads and, you know, things like that have sugar in them. So there's the refined sugars as well. So, but he says, you know, there'll come a day when they'll be able to analyze our metabolism, our genotype, you know, really understand what's going on in your particular body. And until that time, it really makes sense to just eat unprocessed foods, you know, moderation. We keep coming back to it's a very unsexy message, but it really is true.
Right.
And it's really important not to, you know.
To slather butter on everything.
Become extreme.
I'm always amazed. Yeah. I remember being amazed as a kid when people would put butter on their sandwiches, you know, other than. But it just didn't, it seemed like.
Butter and then mayonnaise.
Yeah, and that, yeah, it's like, whoa, that just seemed excessive to me.
Not for the French. They no, not for the French. It's true. Sandwiches all the time.
On the other hand, the biggest revelation for me was when I first had unsalted butter. Now, salting butter was always began from this as a way to preserve it.
Yes.
Right. And that's how we ended up with salted butter.
Yes, and the butter used to be much saltier, about three times
as salty.
Right,
the point where you had to desalinate or whatever you want to call it.
You did. You had to soak it.
The way you do with like codfish.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, so what did you discover about unsalted butter?
How great it is. It was unsalted butter and a fresh loaf from Arthur Avenue. Good, hard, crusty Italian bread.
Yeah.
I was like, this is
heaven.
This is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's very good. And I know. Yeah, I it's still one of my favorite ways, you know, to enjoy butter. And people ask me, well, you know, what's a moderate amount of butter? You know, and the fact is if you eliminate all the sugary things that contain butter, you know, the cookies, the cakes, the pies, you know, reserve those for like a very special treat. You know, and have butter otherwise, have it on your baked potato, have it on your toast, you know, have it on more savory things. I like to cook my fish with butter. You know, you automatically are moderating, you're having a moderate amount of butter if you just eliminate all the sugary things. I think it's as simple as that.
There you go, folks. Eat your butter.
Yeah. Enjoy your butter.
Enjoy your butter.
You don't need to put butter on a croissant.
Moderation in all things.
You don't. If it's a real butter, good croissant.
right. With that caveat. So what's next? I mean, obviously, you know, there has been this trend to write entire books, and you cite one of them, Salt, by Mark Kurlansky, and there have been other books like that.
Many.
You thinking of something else along this line, or...?
Not really. I totally fell in love with this topic.
So you went from the cheese beat to the butter beat.
Yeah. I know. I love the dairy world. I'm fascinated by what can become with just something as simple as milk.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. And I always felt that way in the cheese world. But no, I mean, in my dreams, I would love to turn this book into a documentary.
Yeah.
I think it would be the visual story mm-hmm. is so beautiful. I saw that firsthand.
Yeah, and there are pictures that sort of reinforce that.
I am not a documentarian.
I noticed your daughter took some of the pictures.
Yes. Yes. So I, you know, I could help co-produce, but I need to try to sell this idea to someone.
There's a lot of documentarians around here.
Yes, exactly.
I think it sounds to me like this book is going to be one of people's favorite food books, food history.
I hope so. Thank you.
And I wondered if you knew about this book, which is about the history of the A Joy of Cooking cookbook that Rambauer.
The history of creating the book?
And mm-hmm. in the process of talking about the book and why it was such a huge mm-hmm. success, it kept the publisher of it going for years. I think it was Bob's Merrill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right.
It was like the only book they really had on the market.
Yes.
The name mm-hmm. of the book is Stand Facing the Stove.
I've heard of that. Yes, I have heard of that.
The story of the women who mm-hmm. gave America the joy of cooking, which was my mm-hmm. mother's, you know, Bible.
Bible. I have my own copy. Yeah, very much
worn-out
copy. Of
course, the great butterist was Julia Child.
Yes.
Who never feared too much butter.
Or where is Paula Deen?
I was going to say, yeah. Well,
right, that's true.
She is incredible.
Julia.
But the thing about this book, about the joy of cooking, is that it really is also talking about the history of cooking
in the United States,
what the influences were.
Cooking history has just exploded in our time. It's just amazing. I mean, academic books about food.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, I saw a university press the other day. They have a full length study of the pastrami sandwich.
Yes.
NYU Press just published a book on pastrami sandwiches. I mean, this is it's got you know it's really it's amazing.
How many recipes in that book?
Well, but I'm sure it's the same thing. He probably talks about how someone came up with the idea of making pastrami. You know, and all. Just like you know, one of my favorite parts of your book is I never really understood the whole nature of a ruminant. And what that means, and how that
the ruminant animal,
right? And that's like that was worth.
Well,
reading
I'm glad you there enjoyed
there you go.
That. Yeah, because I have a lot of information about animals in the first part of the book, and I hope you found it interesting.
Ellen just wanted to know what a ruminant is.
What is a ruminant? It is this category of animals that includes the cows, of course, you know, the camel, yak, sheep, goat, so all these animals that you imagine, you know, grazing off the land, and what they have in common is what's called a dental pad. They don't have upper teeth. They tear at the grass, and most importantly, they have this four-chambered stomach that allows them to ferment that grass.
Wow.
And through fermentation, I talk in the book how this Rumpelstiltskin-like effect, you know, that an animal can take just simple grass and turn it into rich, beautiful milk cream. And it's because of the fermentation in their stomachs that completely breaks that down and changes those naked molecules into something else that you can create fat from.
And they come up, they regurgitate it, chew it some more, and
chewing their cud is essentially, they swallow it all, and then it comes back up, and they lie down and relax while they're chewing it, and it goes back through.
I got to tell you, the greatest thing I got out of this book is I have a tendency to use the metaphor of someone churning something, you know, like he churned out something. Now it'll be far more rich for me because now I know what it really means and how it really happened. I mean, this is a lot of churning in this book.
Yeah.
All, and a lot of different methods, Ellen.
Wow.
No.
In India, they have a fascinating way of churning. I that was another stop on my research tour was to go to India because I wanted to see water buffalo butter making. So they historically always used water buffaloes and not cows. But the women traditionally, now of course many of them are using a blender, but traditionally they have put their cream or their milk right into what's like a big vase.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a system of ropes where they basically pull on a stick that turns. They pull on the ropes to turn a stick that's inside this vase of milk, and that's how they churn, which is not done like that anywhere else in the world. It was cool to see.
And
yeah,
Ellen, there's a modern industrial one that looks like something from outer space.
Yeah, the butter cannon.
Yeah.
It does look like a cannon, doesn't it?
It really does.
Well, pretty soon people will have, you know, they have bread-making machines now. They'll have butter-making machines.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you don't need a lot.
You don't really need it.
There's an industrial.
If you have a...
Oh, my.
Yes.
Oh,
that's
my.
An industrial. So that can pump out 22,000 pounds of butter per hour.
Computer-operated
22,000 pounds an hour, Ellen.
Yeah.
Does that sound like heaven to you?
I'm getting really hungry, you know.
But you don't need anything fancy to make butter.
Right.
You can have a food processor, a stand mixer, a blender. You can even just have a jar with a lid and put your cream in there and shake it up. In fact, when
How
I'm
long
doing,
would that take to turn into butter, do you think?
It depends on the volume that you have. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have essentially a pint of cream... In my food processor, it takes about 3 or 4 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah, really quickly. So,
do you like to put in various flavors into your butters when you're making them? I mean,
Not when I'm churning. You know, first I make the butter as is.
Or you do
know,
it after.
Simple. And then while it's soft still, I'll mix in different
So, like,
seasonings.
When you go to a restaurant and they're saying, we have this... Whatever kind of butter, that's how they usually done it.
Definitely, they make a plain butter first, they add, But it's such a like blank canvas for flavor. You can add so many different things to butter to make it fun or interesting. You know, I love a good garlic butter and a good herb butter, but you can do like a honey mustard or a salmon dill. You know, there's some recipes in my book, some variations to get people going. But sky's the limit. You can do a lot with butter.
Great.
Yeah.
Well.
Mm-hmm. So, Ellen.
Yeah.
So, Tom. Thank you so much for coming.
This has been a very savory conversation, Ellen.
Yes. I'm so glad you're interested and
very
cover.
I've been called a foodie in my time, but not really. Mm-hmm. I'm actually just a person who likes to eat.
But it's amazing how much you can talk about butter.
Well, people have been very surprised by the history, you know, of this.
Oh, we should mention, by the way.
That's essentially in everybody's fridge.
Right. You're going to have a personal appearance soon. Was it February?
February 4th.
At Talbot and Arden here on Warren Street.
I'll be signing books there.
You're signing books.
2:00 on February 4th.
2:00, February 4th. Aline Kozorova and her book, Butter, A Rich History. Algonquin Books. It came out like in October, September?
November.
November. Even, it's really hot off the presses, Ellen.
And melting as we speak.
No, the book doesn't melt.
No. And it doesn't have buttery fingerprints on it.
No.
Amazing. But you know I'm obsessive about that, too. Mm. I read books and people can't tell I read them.
Pristine.
You didn't mark up your copy.
No, that's why I have this.
Mm-hmm.
This is when I was a book reviewer, I always figured out a card this size gave me enough notes for a review. So that's how I always did it. Mm. Because, and I can say this now, because I'd always resell all the books I got.
So that's why my book was for sale before it even came out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was on Amazon as a used book before it even was printed by the publisher.
Well, you know, there may have been a pre-publication version that could have been resold, or even the early copies went out. Oh,
yeah,
they definitely go out
early. The early copies were sold because it was hardcover.
The magazine I worked for was a pre-publication review magazine, so it was all way ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. Which one was that?
Kirkus Reviews. Mm-hmm. Did you get reviewed there?
I did.
Oh, positively, I hope.
Yes. Yes.
I've been there for years.
No, mostly I think the one thing they said was should have had more scope. And that was interesting. You know, I feel like I covered a lot of ground.
Scope, yeah, really.
But I think they wanted a more scholarly take on butter, and I specifically didn't want to do it that way. I mean, really, the history of butter could be encyclopedic, and I will leave it to someone else to do that, because it's around the world. There's, you know, many cultures. If you document each and every culture, it would be encyclopedic.
I know. And
but,
you know,
but who could read?
It's a classic. It's a classic dilemma for any author who writes about this way. You know, whether to do something that's comprehensive and scholarly, or something that people are going to actually read.
Yeah.
And this is something people will read.
Well, my editor insisted on something that people will read.
Well, we're heading to the top of the hour.
Oh.
So this has gone fast, and we want to thank Elaine Kozareva for coming in to talk about her new book, Butter, A Rich History, and she will be signing copies February 4th at 2 p.m. at Talbot and Arting. And now you have a long friendship with Kate Arting because the two of you... Mm-hmm. Began a magazine together, or
that's
she
right.
helped you with
Culture She's magazine. Yeah,
that still exists.
Yes, it still exists. We're both, neither of us are involved with it anymore, but it still exists. It's out there. We worked together for 5 years. We launched it with some other partners, and it ran its course for us. I went to Butter, and she went to Hudson.
She's still a cheesemaker.
Oh, yeah. She's a great person to buy cheese from.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She
mm-hmm.
knows her cheese.
Mm-hmm. How big can a magazine on cheese get? I mean, did you have like a serious circulation, or was it so specialized and high priced or something like that?
It's around the country. What helped us is there was really no competition. Mm. It was kind of claimed the market as, you know, at a time when people were really interested in artisanal cheese and where it was coming from and who the makers are and making your own. So, yeah, it definitely has. I mean, niche magazines are the ones that are doing well now.
Yeah. Mm.
The ones that have a dedicated following. It might be small, but if they keep their costs low, they can maintain. It's the bigger magazines.
That's a whole other show, and I'd love to hear about that sometime because I'm always interested in magazine history and magazines. But we have to say goodbye because we're getting to the top of the hour, and we got to play the news. Once again, we want to thank Elaine Kozareva, who was here to talk about her book, Butter, A Rich History.